Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Crime and Mystery Canada. I'm Danielle.
I'm Paul-Emile.
And on tonight's episode, we're going to be talking about the 60s scoop. According to the Indigenous Foundation's arts website from UBC, Patrick Johnston came up with the term 60s scoop in 1983. So he was working on a report called Native Children and the Child Welfare System. And while he'd been discussing some of the practices that had taken place, one of the social workers he was talking to was telling him that in the 50s and 60s, they had this practice of taking, and she referred to it as scooping. So they had a practice of scooping children, of scooping Indigenous children from their families. And that's where the term came from.
Scooping is also a term used in the corrections field. Mm-hmm. When somebody is out on a parole and in a halfway house and breaks his release conditions, they refer to it when they pick him up to bring him back inside the prisons as being scooped.
Right. After I did some research for this episode, it's a term that I find can be a little bit misleading. Not the scoop part, but the 60s part, because the events we're going to be talking about didn't take place entirely in the 1960s. It actually lasted much longer than that. So I find it's a little bit limiting when you're saying 60s scoop. It gives us the impression that it's something that was more or less short-lived.
And also, the 60s were a long time ago, so it's something that we wouldn't think of happened as recently as it did.
Exactly. It kind of, I think it maybe gives permission to people to step away from it, like they're not responsible for it, but it actually went on for a much longer time. According to CBC Doc's point of view, the 60s scoop explained, the term is a global term. It actually describes a series of policies from provincial governments that resulted in the First Nations children being taken away from their birth families. They were then put into foster care and eventually adopted, mostly across North America. So I'm going to quote directly from the Canadian Encyclopedia to explain what the 60s scoop was, because I really tried to come up with sort of a clear, short explanation on it, and was having a hard time. So I'm just going to quote directly from them, and they say that the 60s scoop refers to a large-scale removal or scooping of Indigenous children from their homes, communities, and families of birth through the 60s, and their subsequent adoption into predominantly non-Indigenous middle-class families across the United States and Canada. This experience left many adoptees with a lost sense of cultural identity. The physical and emotional separation from their birth families continues to affect adult adoptees and Indigenous communities to this day. End of quote. So I think that kind of sums it up in a nutshell.
I also think that in discussing or referring to it as a scoop, some of those children were... All of those children were not just kids that were roaming around that were picked up. They were torn apart away from their families.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. So the practice actually began in the early 1950s. The country gave the provinces jurisdiction on Indigenous child welfare. So what happened did vary from one province to the other, and my understanding is it was happening a lot more in certain provinces, but I don't think anyone was innocent of this. We can't really pretend that things had been going perfectly prior to this. I mean, we've talked about residential schools already, but the 1950s is when the practice that we're talking about began. Because a lot of the First Nations communities lacked funding, many families lived in poverty in really poor conditions. Because of this, the government chose to remove the children from their families rather than work on providing them with the infrastructure and the resources that would have put the families in a better position to care for their children. When I use the word care, I mean through basically food, clothing, a warm and dry home, because a lot of the reports go on to say that these children were taken from loving homes where the parents were taking the best care they were able to of the children with the resources that they had available to them. It basically didn't matter that you were a loving parent who was trying to do everything you could for your children. Because you lived in poverty and because you were First Nations, you risked having your children taken away, period.
Somebody sitting behind a desk would make the decision that somebody else was better equipped to raise the child. And the fact that they were in poor families, but loving families, were not taken into consideration.
And if you, I mean, still nowadays, but if you look at the 1960s, just generally, we didn't have the same resources to help poor families. But this was a phenomenon that was happening in First Nations communities. Just because you were a poor white person didn't mean you were going to have your child removed from you.
Exactly.
But in First Nations communities, it was happening all the time. And one of the things that also happened is that the social workers did not have the proper training or understanding of the way that those First Nations people were living. So they would come in and see that the cupboard didn't have any canned goods, there was no food in the fridge, and failed to understand that these families were living off the land. So they were consuming game meat and berries and gardening, and they would judge that as not taking care of their children. Even though they were getting food from a different source than we were used to, they would say, no, you're not properly providing for these children.
I think the other side to that is culturally, it could have been as simple as having a different way to shop. People in Europe tend to buy 1 or 2 days worth of food and visit their local markets, you know, daily or bi-weekly, and buy their products so that they're fresh. And if you went into their homes, you may find that there's not that much available in the fridge, but it's just a different way of getting their provisions. And I think that could have been part of it also.
Right. So there was a lack of cultural understanding. According to the Canadian Encyclopedia, and as I mentioned earlier, this practice began in the 1950s. It really ramped up in the 1960s, but it actually lasted through the 80s. And I think there's even an argument to be said that in a different form, it's still happening today. But back then, the provinces decided that the easiest way to address the issues they had with child welfare was simply to remove the child from their families. And it wasn't until the 1980s that the social workers had to notify the community and ban council of the removal of a child from its home. And I'm not saying that necessarily to put the blame on social workers. Obviously, they were doing what they were told to do. So it was kind of a trickle-down problem, and they were the people at the forefront actually taking the children away. But there was a big problem there. Like you said earlier, someone was sitting behind a desk and made a decision on how things would work without for a minute thinking about the impact and the consequences the actions would have.
And again, it's probably unfair to think or put the blame on the social workers, because they were simply the messenger.
They were enacting the policies, and I'm sure for those people, it was a question of either doing what they were told or losing their jobs. Not that it makes it okay, but just as an example of how staggering the number of children removed from their family was. So in 1951, right before these policies took place, in British Columbia, there were 29 First Nations children in the child welfare system. By 1964, there was 1,466.
That's a big jump.
It's a really big jump. So they went from representing 1% of the children in the child welfare system in the 1950s to representing a third of them in the 1960s. And I think as well, like nowadays, we think about a child going into the system and then the parents having a follow-up plan that they need to follow in order to work towards getting custody of their children back. But often in these cases, that's not what happened. These children were taken away, they were placed into foster care, and then adopted by non-First Nations families. So there was no plan in place for those children to be returned at any point.
Well, I think the intention at the very beginning was just to place them with other families and try and raise them so that they would be aware or exposed or educated into their culture and their heritage.
So they were essentially trying to assimilate them into society and have them forget their own culture or never learn it.
Or be ashamed of it.
That as well. Sometimes they wouldn't even stay in Canada. A lot of them were adopted to families in the US, and some were even sent abroad as far as New Zealand.
There's no coming back from there.
Not really, especially in those days. We touched on this when we were discussing residential schools, but the lost sense of identity that these children had impacted their lives. And even more so when they were placed with non-Indigenous families when they were very young. And once they became adults, if they found out about what had happened to them, they didn't feel like they belonged in the Euro-Canadian families that they'd grown up with, but they also didn't feel a connection to their Indigenous culture. Because they hadn't grown up with it. And like you said, sometimes they were made to feel ashamed of it. It's believed that 20,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were removed from their homes between the 60s and the 90s.
So that's the equivalent of a medium-sized city in our province.
Saskatchewan even had its own adoption agency set up to facilitate adoptions of First Nations children, according to CBC Doc's point of view. So they'd place ads with pictures in the papers so people could see the children and choose which one they wanted to adopt.
So you could go shopping for a child.
Yes. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend I know anything about the adoption process at any point. Because I'm really not aware of the ins and outs. But I always thought it was strange, like when you see a film or something where parents go into an adoption agency and like have a look around and pick one. It always felt really strange to me. But this, they're like advertising in the paper.
Yeah, and when you're going to look around at an adoption or an orphanage, and it's the same as going onto a car lot and looking for a model that you think will you'll like and in the color that you will like. And I can speak a little bit on the adoption side of things because my father was adopted, and to this day I still have questions, and it's still hounding me, and I'm still looking. And there's a sense of wanting to look into the eyes of somebody that's actually a relative. And it's nothing, I'm not comparing this to the scoop, but I'm just saying that where this was done, and it wasn't done to me, it's the next generation, and how it affected me. Being forced on the First Nations children and families would be that much more traumatic.
I can understand what you're saying, like your experience is a drop in the bucket compared to what they went through, but you're still
Right.
feeling the effects of it.
Yes, I am.
So you can only imagine the extent of the effects it had on these people, but like the whole community. It wasn't just one family, it was a whole community of people.
And their futures, the community's future. The children is the future, and by not being raised with the ways of your culture, the knowledge of your culture, the wisdom of your culture, it takes a long time to recover from that.
Sorry, another thing I learned researching this episode was that a lot of single mothers, they were often coerced into actually giving their children up for adoption at birth. So pressure was put in place so that they'd give them up right away. And really, all of these actions were part of trying to force First Nations families to assimilate into the mainstream. Finally, in the 1980s, some changes started taking place. So priorities for adoptions were given to extended families, then to First Nations families when the children were put up for adoption. So they wouldn't immediately go to white families. They'd try to find someone that was related or someone with the same cultural background.
So the goal changed. Rather than purposely placing them with white families, they at least made an effort to try and place them with people within their own culture.
Right. Then in the 90s, they gave the local bands the power to administer child and family services, so they could kind of service within themselves a little bit more. And that means that they came with the understanding of the culture that was there. So the actions that would take place maybe would be a little less, I guess, extreme. But the problem still has not been resolved. In 2016, First Nations children made up 7.7% of the children in Canada, but they represent 52.2% of the children in foster care.
That's unbelievable.
And I think, I mean, Susan and I kind of touched on this during the residential school episode, but you're seeing like generation after generation of trauma and people who were not with their families, so didn't have the structure to learn. Like if you were in a residential school all your life, you didn't learn what a loving mother and father was. You didn't learn how to interact with your siblings because you didn't have that family unit. So I think we're seeing consequences of all the actions that took place prior. Also the fact that the resources that exist are not obviously not doing the job that they're supposed to.
I also think that because of the racism that exists off reservations, outside of their communities, it makes it difficult for them to try and overcome some of the issues that they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. So I think those numbers really indicate that something is still not being done right, and we really need to look at the resources that are in place, find out what's lacking, and figure out how to help these families stay together. And I'm quite aware that I'm saying this without knowing what the answer to the problem is, but I think it just needs, like so much else, it just needs to be looked at. Like it, whatever's happening is not working.
And without adequate consultation with the people that are directly affected by the decisions that are made, I don't think they'll ever get it right.
Yeah.
That the approach needs to change and the people that are affected by their decisions really need to be consulted.
Right, because we don't know. Like, as someone who's not living that problem, you cannot know what that person needs. You need to ask.
It's almost the same idea as seeing somebody with a visual disability, a white cane, standing at an intersection and not asking them if they want help and grabbing them by the arm and bringing them across the street.
When in fact they were just standing there waiting for their bus. Like you don't know what's going on without asking.
Right. And I think that's a little bit the approach that is being taken. They think they've identified an issue and come up with a solution for it without consulting the people that are directly affected.
So a lot of the victims of the 60s scoop were facing obstacles even later in life. Another issue that they faced is that for the children that were adopted to learn about their backgrounds or find out who their parents were, the system required both the consent of the child and the parent. So if you're a child that's been adopted and you're not aware of it, how are you supposed to consent to something like that? So because it was both sides that needed to, some of those children would never learn about their past or only learn about it much later in life.
Right.
In 2015, the government of Manitoba publicly apologized for the 60s scoop. This was followed a few years later with an apology from Alberta and Saskatchewan. I didn't find any apologies from the other provinces. My understanding was that the bulk of the issue taking place were in those provinces, but I did find a mention of Ontario as well. I just think if any of it was taking place in any province, the government should be held accountable and publicly apologize for it. It's the same with the residential school thing where the government wouldn't compensate victims from Newfoundland because Newfoundland wasn't a part of Canada when it happened. I just feel like once you joined Canada, you took responsibility. Like, the country took responsibility for, you know what I mean? For yes, the actions yes. that had taken place. So I just feel like if it happened anywhere, an apology should happen.
Well, it's the same thing, you know, when Newfoundland joined Canada, it's like accepting another member into a family. And you're responsible for the whole thing, not just what happened before they joined the country. So
right. The 60s scoop is now taught in certain provinces' curriculums, but not all of them.
I grew up probably 2 kilometers from a First Nations community, and to the north of me, and to the east of me, probably 20 kilometers from another one, and didn't know about any of this, including residential schools, until I was an adult.
The same for me. I didn't know about either one of those things. I think I learned about residential schools maybe in my early 20s, and for the 60s scoop, I would say it was listening to a podcast called Finding Cleo, which did not come out that long ago. It's a very good listen. If I'm not mistaken, it's done by CBC.
Yes, it is.
Great podcast, but that didn't come out that long ago, and that's the first time I heard about it.
So they did a great job of keeping it hidden as long as possible.
For sure. There's been a few lawsuits on behalf of the victims of the 60s scoop to help them receive some amount of monetary compensation. As far as I could tell, some of them were settled and some of them are still ongoing. But I think, same as for the residential schools, there's really no amount of money that'll make up for the years these people lost with their birth families and the long-lasting impact that these actions are going to take on the families and the communities as well. It just seems that between residential schools and the 60s scoop, we just took away so much from First Nations families. And unfortunately, just that is even the tip of the iceberg of what happened to them and what they've gone through and currently still are having to live with.
I also think that there's a lot of things that happened that we're not even aware of because the people affected at that time are no longer around. Mm-hmm. And because of the residential schools and this 60s scoop, you had a whole generation of elders that did not have the youth in their communities to pass along their knowledge, and had things happen to them that that generation is not aware of. And they're gone. They can't speak now.
Right. And I think it's really important for us to do our best to learn about these different events that took place. The more we understand and the more it's out in the open, the more we can prevent it from happening again, and the more empathy that we can have for the people who went through it. I think at the end of the day, we need to educate ourselves. So we're going to be finishing up tonight with our moment of kindness. Do you have anything to share?
I'd like to make or have a moment of kindness on my part, and I think it goes a little bit into our topic tonight. The local First Nations community, well, I'm local, it's a short distance from here, Ilsebukduk, New Brunswick, mm-hmm. Lost their arena a few years ago in a fire, and have recently made the cut in the top 4 communities in Canada for Crafts Hockeyville.
Right.
And need people's votes in order to win a prize, and the money would be put towards rebuilding the arena in their community for the youth, and it's a very meaningful building. So I just like to ask people if they could go to the Craft Hockeyville page and cast a vote for the Ilsebukduk First Nations so that they have a better chance of winning that prize, and it would mean an awful lot to their community. And I think it would be a great message for the whole country to get behind them and do something for them so that they can continue to offer services in the community to their youth.
Oh, that's a great idea, actually. So maybe collectively, we can actually all do a moment of kindness and go ahead and vote. I think maybe it'd be a good idea that we post a link to the Craft Hockeyville site so that people can find it easily. So,
And they'll be thankful that we share it. And, we're a fairly large group, and there's a fairly large amount of people that listen to us. So every vote will help. And I do believe that you don't have to live in Canada in order to be able to vote. You can go on the Craft Hockeyville website, but I'll post the information on the page.
and that'll be great. Thanks again to everyone who's been listening. I really appreciate people reaching out with their episode suggestions, which has been happening a few times lately. And I mentioned this last week, but I'm going to say it again this week. The cases that I've been coming across by myself and the cases that are mentioned by people are two completely different things. A lot of the stuff that's emailed to me or suggested, I would never come across just doing a Google search. Thank you so much for that information. I'm going to try to get to all the cases as soon as I can. If you need some extra content of our podcast, you can go on Patreon and look for Crime and Mystery Canada. It's a couple of dollars to subscribe, but you'll get some extra episodes, and there'll be a new full-length episode out on April 7th. You can find us on Facebook. We have a group called Crime and Mystery Canada, and you can also reach out to us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Stay safe out there, everyone, and have a good night.
Good night.